I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Thomas Jefferson is the most confounding, confusing, and enigmatic founding father. He wrote these stirring words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Jefferson also owned many slaves to work his sprawling plantation, Monticello, even though he called slavery a deplorable entanglement and abominable crime. He described the slave trade as this assemblage of horrors, a cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberties. And to complicate matters even further, there is compelling evidence that he fathered a number of children with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings. The National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia explores Jefferson's many contradictions and the questions they raise in a new exhibition, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello. We're going to explore some of those same issues in this hour of Radio Times. Susan Stein is with us. She's the Richard Gilder Senior Curator, also Vice President of Museum Programs at Monticello. And Susan Stein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you here. Also with us is Steve Hahn, and he's the Roy F. and Jeanette P. Nichols Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of The Political Worlds of Slavery and Freedom and A Nation Under Our Feet, which won a Pulitzer Prize. And Steve, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Susan, are we supposed to wrestle with Thomas Jefferson? Is that our goal today and maybe even in the past?
Well, I think our goal is really to understand Jefferson and to understand Jefferson within the context of his time. And there isn't any doubt that this is a complicated story.
And how do you, can we come to a conclusion about Jefferson based on all these contradictions? Can we say he was thus?
I don't think that anyone can offer a single answer or a single interpretation about Jefferson. I think that we all are in his shadow for the words and the aspirations that he espoused. But the story of slavery is very complicated and is a legacy that we're working hard to understand and to interpret.
Do you think, Steve, that Jefferson sort of represents our country in many ways, all the contradictions?
Well, he represents many of the contradictions that were part of our own origin stories, which is how deeply implicated slavery was in our founding, how important it was to the people who made the American Revolution and tried to create the United States, and to the prosperity that the United States had. You know, on the eve of the Civil War, slave-grown cotton accounted for 60% of the value of all American exports. And it's hard to imagine the United States as the expanding, industrializing country as it came to be without slavery as a foundation. So in that sense, Thomas Jefferson is a very compelling figure.
Let me go back. Yeah, go ahead, Susan. Something.
And in Jefferson's time, in 1770, 20% of the American population was enslaved. And that really is a very vivid numerical quantitative statement of the power of that economic engine that was slavery. So that 20% was nearly 500,000 people.
Wow. And there would be no Monticello if there weren't slavery. Wouldn't you say that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Jefferson's livelihood and those of many other planters depended on slavery. And in 1790, there were 293,000 enslaved people in Virginia, 40% of the total population. So this was by no means Jefferson's problem alone. It was a significant national issue.
And I went to Monticello last year in June, and not only is it absolutely beautiful, but you see how close the slave quarters, they don't exist anymore, but how close they were to his house.
The proximity, I think, is striking. And, of course, at Monticello, in any given year, there were about 130 enslaved men, women, and children working there. But there were dozens of people living along Mulberry Row, artisans and domestic workers. And that was very close to the house itself. And then there were others who were housed in the South Terrace under sort of just very, very nearby. And field workers were housed on the sites of the quarter farms.
Right. But when you go there, you realize and learn more about it, it's really more than a plantation. It really is a town. I mean, he created a whole sort of self-sustaining town or village.
I think that that's a very good way of looking at Monticello as a plantation, because it was in many ways a small village, and Jefferson made many efforts to make it self-sustaining, but they did not ultimately succeed.
To you, Steve, and I mean, every plantation, I'm sure, was different. But it is interesting to think about the proximity, how closely people live together.
That's right. One of the things that's really important and powerful about what's happened at Monticello and at other sites like that recently is that it was not all that long ago that Monticello and Mount Vernon, plantations of Madison or large plantations even in the Deep South were presented to the public as if slavery had nothing to do with what they were. We can't do that anymore, and as in the case of Monticello, the encounter that people have is much more profound and thought-provoking, I think. Nonetheless, sometimes slaveholders try to organize the physical basis of the plantation so that the proximity was greater rather than closer. Most slaves did not live on plantations. Most slaves lived on small plantations and farms. So the proximity was much, much greater. At Monticello, there were those who lived in close proximity to Jefferson, but many slaves who did not live in close proximity in other quarters. So I think also what the point that Susan made is a good one, which is those who became planters, and especially those who owned large plantations, oftentimes try to create what were self-sustaining, almost self-sufficient communities. They were the lords over their domain. And Jefferson, the modern enlightened person as he was, also imagined it that way too.
Well, and he had a nailery, right, Susan?
Yes, I think
very active nailery, it sounds.
Yes, what Jefferson tried to do when the agricultural when there wasn't enough money to be gained from agricultural cash crops, he turned to light industry, and he began a nailery, a nail-making factory at Monticello. And he used the work of enslaved boys, young teenagers, to make nails. And in any given day in the summer, they might have made as many as 10,000 nails. So this was quite an enterprise. And Jefferson used those nails in the construction of Monticello and its fences and buildings, but he also sold them. But eventually that didn't work out so well because there were cheaper imports to be had.
Do we know how he treated his slaves? Do we know?
We know a fair amount of how he treated his slaves. And he generally, and that's a question that's often asked at Monticello. And of course, within the context of slavery being a coercive and essentially violent institution, Jefferson tried to ameliorate that. He tried to incentivize people who worked at Monticello rather than threaten them. But he was absent for many years while in public service in Washington, in France, in Philadelphia, and his overseers did not necessarily carry out his wishes. And there were people who were violent at Monticello.
Whippings and beatings?
Sometimes, I think really the threat, Jefferson himself is not known to have ordered any whippings, except one instance comes to mind.
Does he break up families?
Jefferson,
do we know?
That great question. Jefferson really tried to keep families together, and when enslaved people married people abroad, that is, from other plantations, he buys their spouses so that they can be at Monticello. And he tries, he recognizes the importance of families. And you can even see this by studying the architecture of the plantation, where you see in the 1770s, people were, enslaved people were housed in multiple family dwellings, but by the 1790s, Jefferson saw that individual houses were constructed so that slave families could live together.
Steve, yeah, go ahead.
One of the things I would say is I think that we need to push back against this issue about treatment. As if somehow or other, if we can demonstrate that a particular slave owner looked out for his slaves or their material conditions were fairly good, that somehow or other that absolves them or suggests that slavery may not have been all that bad. I think the relevant issue is that all slaves, regardless of where they lived, were the property of their owner. All slaves, regardless of where they lived, were under the absolute authority and power of their owner. One of the things that 12 Years a Slave made clear,
I was just thinking of that,
is that you were constantly in danger of being sold, of being whipped, of being abused in any one of a number of ways. And it's important to recognize that for all the slaves that Jefferson owned over the course of his life, he only emancipated, what, eight? A couple of them by will. He didn't even provide for their emancipation at his death. So whether he, and also the issue about families, slave marriage had no standing in law. Slave children were owned by the owner, and the status of enslavement descended from the mother. Jefferson, those slave owners who allowed slaves to have a family life were basically responding to pressures from the slaves. When they bought slaves or tried to unite families that were abroad marriages, oftentimes they did it for expediency because slaves ran off to be with their family members. So again, I would just say that the issue of treatment, I don't think has great relevance, whether Jefferson was a great guy or whether Jefferson was a monster. He certainly recognized in Notes on the State of Virginia about the impact that slavery and the absolute domination over slaves had on owners, too.
Quick response, if you could.
Yeah, I agree with what Steve has said, that's absolutely right about slavery broadly. And
shall we come back to that? Yeah. I'm going to give you a chance to think it over. That's okay. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We are talking about, I guess, wrestling with this idea of Thomas Jefferson and the fact that he owned in his lifetime about 600 slaves, many of them working at Monticello. And again, Susan Stein, our guest, she's the Richard Gilder Senior Curator, Vice President of Museum Programs at Monticello. Steve Hahn is a history professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He's written a number of books about slavery in America. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you make of this apparent contradiction? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. April 9th through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the real-life computer hacker who designed a lot of the tech you see on the hit series House of Cards.
We wondered all these things that people would be able to recognize. When you zoom in, you can really recognize them, but you can also see that they were still drawn a little prettier than they normally look.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, where the hospital's new expansion offers the promise of hope and healing to children and their families. Opening this fall, it will include a state-of-the-art emergency department, spacious private rooms, and a nurturing healing garden. Designed by families, for families, it offers advanced pediatric care and peace of mind. More information at Nemours.org. Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about some of the contradictions and paradoxes of Thomas Jefferson and slavery, the fact that he owned some 600 slaves in his lifetime. Again, Susan Stein, Monticello's senior curator, is with us, as well as Steve Hahn, who specializes in slave history as a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And I just want to give you a chance, Susan, to stay on the air what you and Steve were talking about during that very short break.
What I said was that the question that a lot of people want to know the answer to is, how were slaves treated at Monticello? And really, at the heart of that is, were slaves beaten? Were they physically abused? And I agree that with Steve that the more important question is about the nature of slavery itself, that although it was a violent system, and the nature of it prohibited what we would consider like ordinary human consideration.
Sure. But and this is my intro was sort of about what Jefferson said, Steve, mm-hmm. or what he had said during his lifetime about slavery, and then the fact that he owned slaves until he died. Mm-hmm. Does that make him a hypocrite? I mean, he clearly was struggling with this, but nonetheless, you know, George Washington freed his slaves well before Thomas Jefferson did.
I don't think the issue is whether he was a hypocrite. And in fact, one of the things that to me is so interesting about Jefferson is that there is a history of Jefferson on slavery, that he has developing views. The most, what we might regard anti-slavery public statements that he made were relatively young in his life, in the 1770s and into the 1780s. Where he not only condemned the British for inflicting slavery on their colonies in North America, but where he did make certain propositions. He had a gradual emancipation proposition. He called on Congress to keep slavery out of the Trans-Mississippi West. But after the Haitian Revolution, this is really the turning point. Jefferson always knew that he and other slaveholders sat atop a volcano that could erupt at any time. And however ignorant and inferior he thought slaves were, he seemed to think that they were quite able to understand the very principles in the Declaration of Independence that he had written about. So his public statements against slavery pretty much end in the 1790s. And then as president, he actually acts to expand and strengthen the foundation of slavery in the United States rather than to headed toward some form of extinction.
Well, let me pick up on that and go back to you, Susan. I mean, could we say then that because Jefferson, in a sense, needed his slaves to run Monticello, and we know there were times when he was in debt, that even if he had these lofty statements, nonetheless, he needed to pay his bills, and he needed slaves in order to have some kind of an income?
There is certainly an economic self-interest in slavery, but with Jefferson, I think that an important question to ask is what did compel Jefferson? And what Jefferson believed, I think, was his greatest objective was to secure the future of the experiment in self-government that he had helped to found. Mm. And for me, I think he's willing to compromise slavery. He's willing to compromise on that issue, as were other of the founders, in order to hold the Union together. And what he feared most was the dissolution of the United States.
But it's let me just toss this out there, and Steve, I'll give you a chance to come back. But you know, here's a man of the Enlightenment, right? I mean, he, you know, a man who thought great philosophical thoughts. I think we're all wrestling with the many contradictions of this man.
Well, I think not only the many contradictions of this man, but with this age. And what he thought is that slavery, that he understood that slavery was a huge national problem, but he believed that it was a problem that needed a democratic resolution, that simply his freeing his slaves would not be enough to solve this problem. And it needed to be something that was a collective decision. And indeed, it took the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation, and the 13th Amendment.
Go ahead, Steve.
Well, you could make an argument that it's less contradictory than it might appear at the surface. Jefferson was clearly at the radical end of the political cohort of the late 18th century and had clearly been influenced by Enlightenment ideas. The Declaration of Independence is unquestionably one of the most, not only important, but radical documents of the 18th century. But when he said that all men were created equal, it wasn't simply a gender idea. And in 1785, he published Notes on the State of Virginia, where he speculated on the capacities of people of African descent. One of the reasons that I think Jefferson is so interesting to look at is that he encapsulates what the big problem facing the country is, which is how do you get rid of slavery? I think he was deeply troubled by slavery. I think he knew it was a dangerous situation. And I think he knew that he and other slaveholders were living on borrowed time. Nonetheless, the question is, what do you do about it? And this was an issue that not only Jefferson had a hard time dealing with, but radical abolitionists. The only one in the United States who had any plan for ending slavery was John Brown. Now, whether you like his plan or not, it was a plan.
Right.
William Lloyd Garrison did
really
not have a plan. Frederick Douglass did not have a plan. Thomas Jefferson, when he would confront the issue of what you do with it, first of all, slaves were property, and what are you going to do about that? Second of all, what are you going to do about a large population of people of African descent who are now free? Jefferson became really one of the first colonizationists, meaning His rhetorical solution was that the only way we can possibly abolish slavery is also providing for the removal of the African descended population. Of course, this was going to present big problems about who was going to work at Monticello.
Indeed.
So this was the conundrum.
Well, we are talking about Thomas Jefferson and slavery. That's Steve Hahn, also with us, Susan Stein. And we do have some callers. I do want to get to them in just a moment or two, but I want to throw something else on the table for us to discuss. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Susan, let me go back to you, and let's put Sally Hemings on the table for discussion as well. And I have to say, in preparation for this interview and some of the reading I did, it's still not clear to me whether there's absolute definitive evidence that Thomas Jefferson fathered children with Sally Hemings. Do we have the absolute irrefutable truth on that?
Well, I think that most historians now believe that Thomas Jefferson fathered six children of Sally Hemings long after his wife died. And that conclusion is based on scientific evidence, on some DNA studies that linked male Jefferson DNA chromosomal analysis with a descendant of Eston Hemings, and Eston was one of Sally's children. So I think that by the standards that historians supply or analyze in these matters, that is a reasonable conclusion.
And can we also say that Jefferson's wife was the half sister of Sally Hemings?
Correct. That's right. Her
father. They had the same father.
They had the same father, John Wales.
How do you think about Sally Hemings, or do you?
Well, I think everybody who looks at Jefferson thinks a little bit about Sally Hemings, and as Susan well knows, for a long time there was enormous pushback about this. I think what it reminds us of are the many violations that take place under slavery and the great power that slaveholders had, and whether they developed loving relationships, which some of them did, or whether they took care of their children, which some of them did. Nonetheless, it was a relationship of power and violation and violence. And this was a part, and a big part, of the vulnerabilities that slaves, especially female slaves, had to endure.
Is there any way for us, I'm back to the relationship question, but is there any way for us to know the nature of the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings?
We have some very good hints about it, and there's a lot of reading to be done on this topic, and I direct everyone to Annette Gordon Reed's book, The Hemingses of Monticello, which has a very good analysis of this. But I think that I look to the account of Madison Hemings, who described his mother as Jefferson's concubine. What we know about the relationship is that it was sustained over a number of years, but we really can't make any inference about the emotions that might have been involved there.
He didn't free her, though.
She was given her time at the time of his death, and the people that Jefferson freed during his lifetime and in his will were all Hemingses. They were all extended members of that family. One thing that you will find when you look at Madison's account is his recognition of Jefferson's giving him and his brother, Esten, the tools of their trades. They were trained as artisans. They were very skilled carpenters. So they were able to take care of themselves. They had livelihoods, and Jefferson saw to that.
Mm. Again, Steve, anything you want to add? Then we'll get to our caller.
What we do know is that there were slave women who entered into consenting relationships with their owners for all sorts of reasons, to protect themselves, to better their own circumstances, and probably more than anything else, give their children the potential access to emancipation, because we do know that certainly by the 19th century, many of slaves who were privately manumitted were the offspring of slaveholders relations between mm-hmm. slaveholders and slave women.
Just to follow up, and having interviewed you about your books, Steve, what you have described, though, broadly speaking about slave culture, is that many slaves, they were not necessarily passive victims. They created a very vibrant culture, a communication systems. I mean, there were ways that they were connected to the world outside of slavery.
But as you can imagine, this opens up a whole gender component of slave community and slave resistance, so that slave women, for example, who were being coaxed or coerced by their owners and who were trying to decide how to handle it, had to deal not only with the potential fallout from their owners, but also the potential isolation that would come in relationship to other slaves on farms or plantations. So that resistance works in all sorts of complicated ways, and this is something that works among slaves as well as between slaves and their owners.
Let me get to, looks like Gary from Malvern to join our conversation. And Gary, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
A couple of years ago, the Smithsonian Magazine did a really excellent article on this very subject. And one of the things that I'd like to bring up is just how the Monticello itself was one of the reasons why, well, let's just say Jefferson overreached. He financially overreached. He got himself in a bind he couldn't get out of. That's why he didn't get rid of his slaves.
Because he was in debt, you're saying? He had financial problems?
He was in debt, big debt. And when you figure that the nail factory, which was a horrendous thing, you had children there, you know, working so hard. You had the nail factory, and let's you know, when we say that slaves were property, they're breeding stock. They can sell the children. They can. This isn't like something abstract. So he had that in mind, and that's why, in the end, he didn't really, he sold his slaves off to pay his creditors.
Well, Gary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Susan Stein a chance to weigh in.
Thanks for your question. It's certainly a series of important issues. And I'm not sure exactly where to begin with them, but I'd say that Jefferson didn't intend to sell off his slaves. When he died in debt, and the sale of his property occurred after his death in January of 1827. But and the nail factory, I think, was very closely monitored by Jefferson. He used that as an opportunity to identify the slave boys who were the most efficient so that they could become artisans and learn more advanced trades. One of them, Isaac Granger Jefferson, came to Philadelphia to learn tinsmithing, for example. So I think that I will give you an answer that most historians do, that it's important to look at context here. And while enslaved children are the idea of working, of children laboring laboring like that is hard for us to look at, it was very common throughout the 19th century to see children working.
Like textile factories.
Yes.
Yeah, and I should say, Gary, I'm looking at my computer here, sort of sums it up saying basically Jefferson was a hypocrite. Can we say that, Steve?
As I sort of suggested before, I don't think that hypocrite is a good way of describing the complexities of his thought, that he was not alone among slaveholders and even political revolutionaries of this period, of speaking about freedom in certain ways and owning slaves or at least accepting slavery in other ways. The issue is how he understood freedom and what that required. There's a very, very old and good piece by Edmund Morgan called Slavery and Freedom, the American Paradox. And that was really Morgan's point, is that Jefferson's idea about freedom was organized around the idea of independence, economic independence. Those were the only people who could truly be free. And those who were not economically independent and like slaves or like women were dependent. We're not truly free people, so he didn't see it. If you talk, Susan made a good point about context, but this is not only a social context, it's a political context as well. I think it's important for us to recognize the political world that Jefferson lived in and how his ideas were not regarded as contradictions until people in the anti-slavery movement began to push back.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And again, we are talking about Thomas Jefferson and slavery. There's an exhibition called Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, and it runs through October 19th here in Philadelphia. And again, Susan Stein is our guest. She's the Richard Gilder Senior Curator, also Vice President of Museum Programs at Monticello. And our guest, Steve Hahn, is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, has written a number of books about American history and slavery, including the political worlds of slavery and freedom. And he also wrote a book that got a Pulitzer Prize called A Nation Under Our Feet. We're going to get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have an email from Jeff. We'll get back to that as well. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. And Jefferson would probably like tweeting. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Yes, he would be fascinated by that. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from Social Justice Community Counseling or Child and Adolescent Counseling. More information about a Master's of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
When remembering is as painful as forgetting.
The tone was telling them that it's okay to go out and kill the neighbors. They will be doing a duty that is expected of them.
20 years after the genocide in Rwanda, there's a global village of survivors, a conversation with one Rwandan woman who helps hold them all together. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra, under John Andrea Nuzzada, performs Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the power of the Fred J. Cooper Memorial Organ's 6,938 pipes. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about how to reconcile or perhaps the irreconcilable relationship between Thomas Jefferson and slavery. Let me get Ed from Burlington, New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm only calling in reaction to a statement one of your guests made that there were slaves that entered into consenting relationships with their masters. And quite frankly, that's an oxymoron. There's no way I can get that my head around that. And I'm wondering, A, what's that based on? And two, further exploration as to how someone who's enslaved can enter into a consenting relationship as opposed to acquiescing, as opposed to basically thinking it's the best of horrible choices.
Sure, Ed.
I'll
think,
hang up with
sure,
them.
No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Steve, I actually think you answered that.
Well, I do think, you know, the point you made is it's the best of horrible choices. And consenting meaning that they became, as Sally Hemings did, a concubine, a woman who had a ongoing relationship that was sexual and perhaps involving other emotions, and that they did that for a variety of reasons, most of which were strategic, and to protect themselves, to better their circumstances, and then to enhance the prospects of their kids becoming either emancipated or being trained or a whole variety of things.
And thanks for the call to Radio Times. Susan, let me put this to you. There was a guy named James Callender, who I guess was one of the first people to talk about Sally Hemings as a, quote, concubine. But he was a muckraking journalist?
Well,
or maybe you can describe.
Callender was a journalist, and he was a disappointed political office seeker, and he held Jefferson responsible for that. And he published in 1802 an account of Jefferson's relationship with an enslaved woman. And that story has been the subject of discussion ever since.
We have an email from Jeff. Was it all economically feasible for slaveholders to make a profit, to pay whites and blacks to work the land? I mean, would that have even been possible without slavery? Could they have worked? I'm looking at you, Steve. Worked the land and made it profitable?
Well, one of the things that slavery does, and we have to recognize that until the late 18th century, slavery was a central way in which social and labor relations were organized, not only in British North America, but all over the world. Slaveholders and other people who were landowners and employers of other sorts didn't imagine that you could get anyone to work for them unless you forced them to do that. Now, Jefferson sort of had ideas about how you might be able, because he was an advocate of small white farmers, yeomanry, that you might be able to get tenanted plantations and do that with a combination of labor relations. But what's interesting in the United States is that this is not something that gets anywhere with slaveholders. And indeed, once slavery ends, slaveholders are looking for any coercive device that they can implement to prevent slaves, former slaves, from taking off, from trying to subsist on their own account, from leaving them. And so there's a very, very extended transition where former slaves are, you know, struggling to get out from under the thumbs of their owners.
Because it's backbreaking work, right?
It's backbreaking work. And again, most people, if they have the opportunity, and Jefferson himself would have recognized this better than anyone else, They want to be economically independent. They want to work for themselves. They want to be heads of their own households, and they don't want to be under anyone else's thumb.
Yeah. Go ahead, Susan.
And indeed, at Monticello, one of the strengths of this exhibition is that it demonstrates how Monticello's enslaved people really had lives independent of Jefferson. And recent research at Monticello and at dozens of other plantation sites in the U.S. and the Caribbean show that enslaved people had lives independent of their masters, and they earned money on their own. At Monticello, they earned gratuities for unpleasant tasks. They had poultry yards where they raised chickens that they sold to the Jefferson family. They raised vegetables and sold them to the family. So they had money. They were earning money. They were part and parcel of the Atlantic economy, and they bought things like China wares that in shops in Charlottesville. So they all owned tea wares and ceramics from a variety of places. And what this shows is that they had more independence than people had previously understood.
You agree with that, Steve?
Well, I do, but the only thing I would add to it is that slaves increasingly over the southern United States, where slavery was foundational, had access to provision grounds where they could spend their off hours working. They sometimes could raise crops. They sometimes could raise small livestock or poultry. In some cases, they were could sell. Usually to their owner. Their owner didn't want them to sell to people off the plantation. And they were able to acquire small possessions. So this was, I think, as Susan very rightly says, an aspect of slavery in which slaves attempted to construct a world of their own that was as much independent of the owner as possible. And it was a product of their own pressure. But the important point is that there was no legal basis for it. So at any point, the slaveholder could withdraw it. The slaveholder saw it as a privilege. Slaves saw it as a right. This was sort of a basis for conflict, but it did mean that slaves were able to make small accumulations over the course of the 19th century and late 18th.
Let me get Barbara from Broomall to join our conversation. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was calling to find out if the speakers could address Thomas Jefferson's relationship with Thomas Kosciuszko. I believe I'm pronouncing that right. It's my understanding that Kosciuszko fought in the Revolutionary War, and he and Jefferson were good friends. And on his deathbed, he said that he would leave money in his will for Jefferson to free the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure what happened. I know that there's a book written about it by Graham Hodges. But I thought that Jefferson took the money, but then he borrowed against it, but the slaves were never freed.
Well,
if they could speak about that.
Sure. Let's find out, Barbara. Let me toss that to you, Susan Stein. Go ahead.
Great story. There have been two books published recently about Kosciuszko and Jefferson, and I think that you don't have the facts exactly right. And the story is that, as I understand it, is that Kosciuszko wanted to name Jefferson as an executor of his will. Jefferson, and that came with the stipulation that he would give Jefferson money to free some of his slaves. But Jefferson was elderly at that point, and he knew that the will was going to be in court, and in fact, the will was not resolved until 1853.
Wow.
So it's a little bit different than what's been presented, but certainly the idea at the heart of what you mentioned was there.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Let me get Chris from Bala Cynwyd to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have you, Chris?
Nope. Bit of go ahead, research. Hi, can
Hi
you
there.
Hear me?
Yes, now we can. Yeah, go ahead.
I've done quite a bit of genealogical research on my family and for significant numbers of slave owners in it, and I'm noticing a connection with the information I uncovered with this talk on Jefferson, and specifically, you know, a point came up about potential hypocrisy of Jefferson, and I don't think he was a hypocrite either. I think that he really was more a product of his environment and time. I look at these wills that I've found, and, you know, slaves are listed among pieces of furniture and farming equipment and not necessarily at the top of the list. And it's all very cold to, I think, a modern reader, but I guess that's the way it was looked at the time. And I don't know that he was, I think it's we'd almost be plucking him out of his era and putting him in now and judging him. And I don't know that that's necessarily fair to him.
Well, Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Steve, I bet for a number of people in this country, if they were to dig back into their history, and if they're white, they would find slaves or former slaves.
You know, one of the things we find out more and more is that slavery was epidemic or people's long-term connections. So there have been a lot of really interesting projects at universities, especially in the East Coast, that have shown the variety of ways in which the institutions themselves benefited from slave owners. And, you know, I think this is true, and it's a very unsettling but important thing to recognize.
Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Susan, back to you. Thinking about the descendants of Thomas Jefferson, I don't know how many there are today or how many count themselves as the descendants. Do they have things in common? Is there something that would mark them as the ancestors of Thomas Jefferson?
Well, there
are...
The children, I should say. Great question, Marty. There are about 2,000 living descendants of Jefferson's daughters, Martha and Maria, and there are many, many other descendants of the Hemings family. And I don't think that they're actually a great composite of all American families. And their members run the gamut from policemen and teachers and educators to lawyers, but it's a very wide-ranging group, and they live all across the country.
And do they?
And you might even know some of them.
Oh, interesting. and do they think of themselves? I mean, broadly speaking, as a big family. Some of them, anyway.
I think that they do think of themselves. They're mostly very proud of their association with Jefferson, whether they are descendants of the Hemings or of Martha and Maria, his daughters, and they take great pride in that and meaning from it as well.
Steve, let me make a leap from Jefferson to Lincoln. And I know this is, I mean, certainly something that you've written a lot about. And even Lincoln's own, I don't know if reluctance is too hard a word, but he sort of had to get dragged into this issue of freeing the slaves.
Well, you know, that's, Marty, that's a very good point. Lincoln was centrally part of what became a mass anti-slavery movement, but it was focused not on abolishing slavery immediately in those states where slavery was legal, but in preventing slaves from moving out into the Trans-Mississippi West. Lincoln, like Jefferson, was a colonizationist. Lincoln believed that removing the black population was not only the way of maintaining social peace, but probably for political reasons, the best way to convince a white public in the North about the wisdom of anti-slavery. And Lincoln was thinking about colonization well into the Civil War. Now, and was looking at various places in the Central America or the Caribbean where freed slaves might go. If you got down to it and said, how would this be financially viable? It wouldn't have been.
Right.
But rhetorically, it was very important.
Let me get to, go ahead, Susan.
I would just have one thing to say about Lincoln. It's really Lincoln who, in a sense, brings Jefferson back into the public eye. Because in the 1850s, Lincoln turns to Jefferson and cites in speeches and in letters that it was Jefferson's words who gave hope to all future mankind. Mm-hmm. So he's touching that spot, and in a way, he's also infusing Jefferson's words with the modern meaning that they have for us today.
Mm-hmm. Let me squeeze in another caller. We have Philip from Bucks County. Philip, you're going to have to make it snappy, but go ahead, you're on Radio Time. Sorry about that.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome.
Yeah, just an observation applicable to both Lincoln and Jefferson. I heard someone call Jefferson a hypocrite earlier, but I think that's a bit of an indulgence. I think it's better, and I think the professor would agree, it's more of a situation of cognitive dissonance where knowing something is right or wrong, but because of your duty, whether it had been as a president, or being that slavery was in fact an institution and a fact of life. I think it's an indulgence to consider either one of them a hypocrite, because they were actually both very forward thinkers at the time. Like the professor said, I don't think that absolves any of Jefferson, what Jefferson is accused of, so to speak. But I think that hypocrisy is a little bit of an indulgence, and it's more of a cognitive dissonance.
Okay, fair enough. Philippa, go ahead, Stephen.
Yes.
I hear some tentativeness
no question
in your
about
voice.
That, but, you know, one of the things that is important to recognize about Jefferson, too, is that Jefferson saw slavery as the alternative to disorder, and he couldn't figure out how you had social peace and got rid of slavery. It's worth pointing out that during the Haitian Revolution, and when Jefferson was elected president, which was in 1800, at the very tail end, the Toussaint Louverture and the new slave-free people of color regime in Haiti actually had a developing alliance with the Federalists, because the Federalists not only disliked the French, but they had close relations with merchants who had long-standing trading relations in Saint-Domingue, about to be Haiti. When Jefferson was elected president, he was so terrified by what had happened in Saint-Domingue that he basically gave Napoleon the green light to send his troops in and to reimpose slavery. Now, this was an enormous thing to do because it would have sacrificed his own interests in expanding into the Trans-Mississippi West and would have enabled Napoleon to construct a New World Empire linking Louisiana and Saint-Domingue. So, you know, if he had to make a choice, he'd hold on to slavery.
On that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Steve Hahn, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, has written a couple of books about slavery, The Political Worlds of Slavery and Freedom and A Nation Under Our Feet, which won a Pulitzer Prize. Susan Stein, the Richard Gilder Senior Curator and Vice President of Museum Programs at Monticello. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can carry on this conversation. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. And you can